Our Social Security and unemployment insurance.
Here's broadside.
That we all can get lost. But it's true. They still do. They can still get lost. It's right under your eyes. All around the city. Right under your eyes. All around the city. You wouldn't think in this age of psychoanalysis and modern housing developments that people can get lost. But it's true. They still do. They can still get lost. It's true. Right under your eyes. All around the city. Right under your eyes. All around the city.
Why, two busy bees are busy, busy buzzing in your eyes. We are busy, busy leading our peculiar lives. We have no steady home address, no doorbell and no doormat. We live from day to day by our own ingenious format. You can't tell us from the solid comb. We look so neat and right. We take no handouts. All we need is enough to eat and a place to sleep at night. Subways are for sleeping, and so are so many other places. Lofts and cellars and fire escapes, car lots, museums and excavations. When the night comes creeping, find an empty baggage car. For if you know your way around, over in and underground, from the Jersey to the Long Island Sound, you can sleep wherever you are.
Subways are for sleeping, and this show is for talking and staying awake and getting on the case. I'm Robert Norse, and for the next 2 hours, I invite you to join me either in the studio or out of it, at your radio or at your telephone, wherever you happen to be, kind of filling us all in on what's going on around Santa Cruz. For those of us who are outside, those of us who are poor, those of us who don't have much money, and those of us who find ourselves at the business end of the business in these rainy, cold times. What we're going to be talking about and covering this evening, a number of topics. We kind of go around the state. We've got a report from Buena Vista down south on the Reverend Wiley Drake and his attempt to, well, his successful actions in keeping homeless people in his church at night in spite of actual prosecution by city authorities. Last summer he was convicted, and the judge felt that having convicted him, he had to essentially commend him and gave him no criminal time, no community service time, no probation. In fact, didn't even tell him he had to stop doing what he was doing. And we're going to get an update on that story. We're going to get a brief update on the Oregon situation, where, as you may know, unlike in Santa Cruz, it is legal for people to sleep in their vehicles in industrial areas. So they've actually taken a step toward compassion, toward common sense, toward common decency in Eugene that Santa Cruz has yet to take. And once perhaps we can persuade our city council, Rotkin Matthews majority, Rotkin Matthews, Hernandez, and Campbell, and I guess there's another one in there as well, who are declining to allow any modifications of the anti-homeless law in Santa Cruz that makes it illegal to sleep outside or cover up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night, then we can catch up with Eugene. And that would be nice, wouldn't it? We're also going to have reports on things happening in different parts of the world. The homeless in France and the unemployed are not taking this kind of quiet, let's wait and see and hope that we get a handout from this social service agency or that, hope that something happens next week. hope that somebody else takes some action. No, folks are getting together in France and are actually doing something to fight back, and that's catching world headlines. Then there's we're going to be covering general police misconduct and civil liberties as well, and of course the ongoing Happy John Dine case reached a climax, or perhaps a nadir, if you will, a real low on Monday when the Citizens Police Review Board made the decision, and the next day, Tuesday, when they came out with their press conference, and we're going to be covering that press conference, giving you some background on that. You probably have already heard it already from Vinny, V-Man, who has probably been broadcasting what he's taken from the press conference. We're going to be discussing it and inviting you to discuss it. And again, you're tuned to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. The studio line here, if you want to join us, is 423-5361. We have open lines, so whatever your heart desires, you know, hop on the phone and give us a call. We're also going to be talking about street newspapers. Used to be underground newspapers. Now we've got sort of street newspapers. We got street newspapers, and we got these kind of artsy-fartsy advertising throwaway newspapers. They aren't really artsy-fartsy. They're just kind of fartsy-fartsy. But there are, in cities across the North America, even in, and across Europe and England, newspapers that are concerning themselves with civil rights for folks who are either homeless, poor, alternate lifestyle. And there's an issue that's, as these small newspapers start to grow and pop up in different cities like free radio stations, alternate means of communication and of expression, the commercial media want to horn in, want to muscle in, want to exploit. So it is that, for instance, The Big Issue, which is the name of a paper, it calls itself The Big Issue in England and to some extent in Europe, South Africa, and Australia. They recruit homeless vendors to sell their paper, and they kind of have homeless projects. And they, in essence, snuff out homeless newspapers by destroying them through their mega competition, like Blockbuster Video or Crown Books does with smaller retailers in the book business and in the record or the tape and cassette business. We're going to be talking about small newspapers and what's going on around that scene. I'm an editor of an occasional small paper myself called the Street Shit Sheet, and you may have seen my writing in the Street Spirit monthly newspaper. It comes out, published out of San Francisco. You can catch it downtown here in Santa Cruz. It's sold often in front of the Cinema 9 and other places. And plus we have a very colorful and I would even say exciting, irritating, what you will, interview with civil libertarian Richard Quigley, who has been fighting a number of battles to defend the rights of young people at the Aptos Shopping Center who are getting the kind of Santa Cruz Pacific Avenue-style boot. If you've been downtown in the last couple of years, you've seen this growing gentrification whereby new laws have been passed making it illegal to sit down, to lie down, to panhandle and so forth. And the panhandling laws are now, for the last year, actually being enforced. I've heard even, well, 4 hours ago of a man who was arrested for panhandling on a bus. And we're going to talk about the bus situation. I mentioned to you in the past shows how Patricia Gardella, a homeless woman who you used to see sitting at the corner of Ocean and Water Streets with all her stuff, was harassed by the Metro District, actually given a trespassing ticket for sitting on their bench even though she had an all-day pass. We interviewed her attorney, Tony Bull, on this issue, and we interviewed Patricia herself, and they dropped that charge. But apparently they were so determined to make sure that Patricia did not sit on that bench that they removed the bench. So if you go by Water Street and Ocean, which is right next to a gas station there as you head into town, turning off Ocean Street, turning right onto Water, you will see that there is no bench anymore. So in order to get rid of this unsightly menace to the Santa Cruz fashion scene, the authorities in the Metro District decided to remove the benches. Now, of course, you see, we've seen this kind of stripping the area of forage, stripping the area of shelter and cover when they redesigned the downtown Santa Cruz Mall to eliminate bushes, to straighten it out, to eliminate most of the sitting places. And when they did this, we were assured by Mike Rotkin and Neil Coonerty and Scott Kennedy and all those great liberals and progressives that, oh no, we're putting in more bench spaces than ever. Well, if you looked up and down the mall recently, particularly around Cathcart and Pacific, you see they pulled out the benches. They don't want people to cluster. They don't like scenes to develop. The scenes they have in mind are commercial scenes. The scenes they have in mind are middle-class scenes. If we are talking about street scenes where people are clustering together to form affinity groups on the street, to socialize, young people are trying to get together there, that doesn't please the powers that be, and it pleases them so little, and they are so arrogant in what they do that they don't mind discomforting all the rest of us, including elderly people who'd like benches to sit on, including the rest of us who'd like to be able to sit down without being arrested under their downtown ordinances, which make it a crime to sit down 10 feet from a shop or 50 feet from an ATM. And 10 feet from a shop is going to be kind of hard now because there are all the areas that previously had been undeveloped downtown are now developed. And it's going to be hard to find a place to plant your butt. And Richard Quigley is going to be talking about Aptos and what happened there and the kinds of court struggles that he has been put through. And I think you'll find him enjoyable to listen to. He's been a favorite of mine in the past. And then we also have your host, who I'm going to play a bit of my own. I'm going to kind of toot my own horn. About a year and a half ago, I was jailed for serving soup in San Francisco and served a month there. And as a consequence, probably one of the few fringe benefits I got out of that was an interest by a national news show, kind of a Donahue-style, Oprah Winfrey-type national show, which since has folded. I don't know what that says about me or them. Actually, it was a pretty good show. They did a lot of interesting topics, electroshock. This particular show was Good Samaritans Who Get Screwed, I guess, if you want to put it colloquially. And they had on a bunch of folks who did good deeds and got punished for them, and I was one of them. And we'll play you a little bit of that show, the audio segment. It actually was a video show, and it was better to see it. But still, it's interesting to hear it. It gives you sort of a... It harkens us back to 1996, and those days, to some extent, are gone for Food Not Bombs in San Francisco, which now can serve food without being arrested by the police, but not in, let's say, Worcester, Massachusetts, which is getting Worcester and Worcester. It's the second largest city in Massachusetts, someone told me. And I got a call from their ACLU out there. They talked to me, and they said that the city is planning to bring to trial four members of Food Not Bombs for serving food without a permit, which was the reason I was taken to trial in San Francisco. So it's not really old news. I kind of pulled this thing up as a curiosity, but it gets curiouser and curiouser. Well, let's begin with that segment from the Gordon Elliott Show. And we'll progress to other things. We're also hoping to get call-in interviews with the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, TRUSC, which has been doing a fine job of keeping an eye on evictions but needs your help. It's really understaffed, and the more folks that can get involved with this, the better. And hopefully we're going to hear from Marco or from Donna, and they're going to be filling us in on what's been happening around evictions in Santa Cruz, the attempt to get eviction protections from city council or from the Board of Supervisors, or whoever they're going to at the moment. And you'll be hearing from them. And we also hope to get a kind of an update from SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now. Nicholas Whitehead should be calling in. Looks like we're actually getting a call right now. So let's see what's going on here.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi, Robert.
Hi.
I don't mean to toot your own horn, but I was just listening there. I had a few questions. First, my first question is about Marco from the Tenants' Rights Union. Is there any way you could get him in the studio maybe Sunday to actually field callers? Because I'd like to talk to him about a few things regarding tenants' rights.
I really would like to do that. He has come in the past, and hopefully will come in again.
It probably
depends on his schedule. Certainly, Marco, if you're listening, here's at least one listener who wants you on the air fielding calls. And, of course, if you can't come on to my show, you have a show, too. We are talking, of course, to the infamous V-Man who broke the John Dine case.
That's right.
Take a bow, V-Man.
I'm not like that, actually. I don't need any self-gratification.
None at all. I understand.
the whole thing really upsets me more than it, you know.
Well, maybe now we've got you on the line, we can talk to you. You were at the press conference on Tuesday.
I certainly was.
Yeah, this was the Citizens Police Review Board. You want to give us a kind of a summary of how that went down? Have you already talked about that on the air? Or?
I talked quite a bit about that on the air on the yesterday afternoon, actually, but and last night. Or actually, it was Tuesday afternoon and then last night on my show. But anyway, yeah, I don't know. Just a quick rundown of the, you know, events. I'm not surprised in any way. Citizens Police Review Board to me means nothing because any recommendations they ultimately decide anyway gets basically what people say is rubber stamped by the chief of police. And so I'm not surprised that they reached this decision, but I am, you know, kind of enraged and I feel kind of a loss because this was the very last menial, you know, thing in the process of this whole investigation, and it's like now it's completely official. And the Sentinel, you know, I don't know if you saw the Sentinel, but their coverage of it wasn't quite what it should have been, and it's exactly what I expected it to be.
Well, let me summarize for our listeners, many of whom probably know what went on, but possibly we've got a few new folks listening.
Maybe.
John Dine was shot on November 12th by police officer, Santa Cruz police officer Connor Carey.
Badge number 180.
And badge number 180. Two bullets to the midriff, and he died within a couple hours after. His crime was he had been accused of brandishing a toy gun by a complaining witness, a Catalyst bouncer, Ben Newman, who apparently informed the police officers that he saw this. He got in the back of their squad car, went after, and they went after to find Dine. They jumped out of their car, and within 5 seconds, and I use that phrase based upon the statements of Sergeant Andy Crane, who actually spoke to us at some length about this a couple days ago.
Really?
He said that this happened within 5 seconds, that they got out of the car and they shot him dead. Actually, Connor Carey shot him dead. Martin Over was Carey's partner, of course. And they claimed that Dine had been pointing a weapon at them. Actually, this was a claim by Ben Newman in the back of the car and by Martin Over. Carey claimed that he'd been reaching for a gun. And within 16 hours, Police Chief Steve Belcher and District Attorney Art Danner, in a conference that was videotaped and played extensively later, kept repeating the story that Dine had something in his hand, that which was in his hand was a weapon, that the weapon was pointed at police, that he refused to respond to calls to freeze.
That was the same press conference that you and I and Phil Free were all barred from, is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. That was press conference in the District Attorney's... well, I don't know if it was his office or his press conference area, which supposedly was open to the press, but not apparently to the media that were not willing to kind of roll over for this stuff. you know, not. I mean, I frankly didn't know what happened when I came on the scene. I didn't know who did what. It just seemed that suddenly when we found that every non-police witness claimed that they saw nothing in Dine's hand, nothing in Happy John's hand, nothing pointed at the police, no threatening behavior, and no combat stance. And that's every witness in the DA's report, which can be found in the public library, whereas only three witnesses, the two police officers and the police officer's friend, and that's not used in a slanderous or light fashion. That's how he described himself in an interview afterward. Ben Newman, who had known Connor Carey from youth and was a friend of his, these three individuals, Carey, Newman, and Over, became the official story.
Well, of course. Did you expect anything less?
Well, I like to keep hoping that somewhere along the line, you know, we at least the police department doesn't want to embarrass itself, but within 16 hours after the shooting, this was the story, and it stayed the story as they closed the investigation.
It's still the story.
Well, it's interesting. The story changed, as I can understand it, because what they originally said was, they said that here was a guy, Happy John Dine, who pointed a weapon at the police, refused to drop it, and assumed a combat stance, engaging in threatening behavior, and he was shot down by Officer Carey, what proved to be an unnecessary shooting because it turned out to be a toy gun.
Right.
Well, of course, no other witnesses confirmed this except the three I mentioned, who are the police witnesses, all the non-police witnesses.
Actually, not even all the police witnesses didn't even confirm that.
Quite right, quite right.
I believe Over didn't even say he actually pointed it.
I think it was actually Carey.
Carey, excuse
yeah,
me, yeah.
Yeah, the shooter himself, Connor Carey, said that he was reaching for it.
Right.
So this became the news story. When the Police Review Board reviewed all this, they said that he was reaching for the gun instead of
pointing
it.
But even in their own conclusion press release, which they, you know, put out on Tuesday, they contradict themselves in their own words twice in the report, if you look over it carefully, mm-hmm. where that with that very point, you know, they say, in one sense, you know, they say that, oh, well, he pointed it repeatedly at both of the officers, and then you keep reading, you get a couple paragraphs through the thing, and then it's like, oh, well, he apparently was reaching for it. And we decided that, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Well, the official line often you can tell by reading the Sentinel. And the Sentinel first started out with a pointed story. It went with that for about 2 months. Then when the Police Review Board came back, and we must point out that they have no more new information than the Sentinel had before, now they're saying that he was reaching for it. And so the story kind of twists and turns like a winding stream, a twisting stream, to reflect the gyrations of which witnesses they want to put out as their most credible witnesses. And the problem with the report, and I'm going to actually read the report shortly. Did you read it on the air, Vinny?
I did, yes.
Oh, you already did.
But that was yesterday.
Yeah, well, we can read it again.
That was Tuesday, in fact, in the afternoon, so it might be a different audience altogether.
It might be a different audience. Well, I'll read some of it, and of course I will. Did you play most of the press conference, the tape?
I did, in fact, play it. But that's, you know, again, it's worth hearing for people that have not yet heard it. And
so maybe I'll
free up your phone line since I'm about to eat my dinner. And let people call in if they want.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Vinny.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And Vinny has graciously freed up the phone lines. And you can call in at 423-5361. Lines are open. I'm going to read this report mainly to show you how impoverished it is, how it lacks any discussion of the reasoning that went into it, and to which witnesses they found credible and which they didn't, into who they believed and why. None of that is here. And of course, since their deliberations, that of the Citizens Police Review Board, were in secret, we cannot see, or we cannot hear, and we cannot know what their process was, how they made that decision. Did they just all get together and say, Chief Belcher says this, let's all agree, we don't want to embarrass the chief? I wouldn't want to imagine they wouldn't do such a thing. But even if they didn't say such a thing, was this a strong motivation? We cannot see because we have no window into what they did. Anyway, this is the official press statement made after the Police Review Board visited this matter on three separate closed sessions, which it's something of a record. It's interesting also that they did not go into closed session until a month and a half after this matter was brought to them. So they decided they didn't need an early investigation. They didn't need a special session. The killing of a poor person on the streets of Santa Cruz with two bullets point blank to the midriff in a case that three eyewitnesses called murder is not sufficiently important to really command their attention until a regular session on December 29th, 1997, which is when they went into their closed session. It turned out not to be important enough for them to want to call police witnesses to testify and be cross-examined to get the witnesses the police did not get, of which there were six or seven, and particularly the crucial witness, Tom Murphy, who saw the incident from about 20 or 30 feet away on the corner, called it murder, and actually he was one of the first people that Vinny, the man you just heard on the phone, questioned and testified. Anyway, they apparently felt that the Citizens Police Review Board did not feel it was necessary to meet on this issue until December 29th, and then suddenly decided that they had to rush out a report and couldn't take time for an independent investigation because it would be reckless to delay. And that's nearly a quote from their lengthy, two- or three-page review, which is actually, as I said, pretty empty. But let's hear what happened. First of all, there were two allegations made. Actually, I think there were more than two allegations. This complaint that they were looking at, which is IA-97033, was a merging of about six or seven or eight complaints about the killing of Happy John Dine by citizens who saw it, heard about it, or were outraged by it. And the two prongs to the complaint were, one was that Connor Carey used excessive and lethal force in killing John Dine. And the second was that the police department, specifically Police Chief Belcher, aided possibly by underlings, including Martin Over and those officers supposedly investigating the case, suppressed witness testimony and came out with a conclusion that exonerated the officer and the police department within 16 hours without really considering the real issues, that there was in essence, a cover-up going on. Those were the two complaints that these six or seven, two prongs of each of the six or seven complaints, pretty much, although I haven't got those complaints in front of me. This was what Bill Christie, who's the chair of the Citizens Police Review Board, well, he read some of this, but this is the report that was issued. The Citizens Police Review Board finds the shooting of Mr. John Dine by an officer of the Santa Cruz Police Department justified in accordance with the policies and procedures of the Santa Cruz Police Department. This opinion of the board was reached following extensive review and consideration of the district attorney's formal report, supplemental material provided by citizens and witnesses, commentary provided by citizens at several meetings of the CPRB, audio and videotaped interviews with witnesses and the officers involved, and the dispatch tape. The board then engaged in several hours of deliberation during three closed sessions. I'm going to break away from this for a moment to point out that the board, though it had the two witnesses, eyewitnesses Mike Schultz and Stacy Buckaloo, declined to ask them any questions. They did not. Not only did they not subpoena any witnesses, which they have had the power to do for years and have never used, not only did they not hold public hearings, which they have had the power to do for years but never used, not only did they have the power to ask for an independent investigation from the city manager, which they were actually assured in advance they would probably get if they requested. That was the scuttlebutt going around, that the city council would vote it in if necessary. The city manager would refer it to the city council. But when they actually, in the public comments section of their main hearing, when the two eyewitnesses, probably the most credible of those who've come forward, Stacy Buckaloo and Mike Schultz, came up to the mic and said it was murder, Citizens Police Review Board, it was murder, and this is what happened. They had no questions to ask, nothing to say. This is our investigative body in action. These are the people that city council appoints to review the police department. And one has to ask, if you can't review a murder, what can you review? Anyway, continuing with their final report on the Happy John Dine killing. In these deliberations, the board focused on three issues. First, did the officers act in accordance with the departmental policies and procedures? Second, would the public be served by an independent investigation? And third, is there anything to be learned from this tragic incident? In the first case, the board was challenged by inconsistent witness statements. The board was ultimately able to reconcile the inconsistencies in support of the following account. Now, you'll note that this account is the account of Officer Carey. They finally accepted Officer Carey's account, even though it contradicted Ben Newman, the bouncer, and Officer Over, and, of course, nine other independent witnesses who saw nothing in Dine's hand, and no combat stance and no threatening behavior. The board was ultimately able to reconcile the inconsistencies in support of the following account. Officer Carey was approached by a witness, Mr. Ben Newman, who reported seeing Mr. Dine brandishing a weapon. Let it be noted that we have not heard the reports of his brandishing a weapon were supposedly from either skateboarders or skinheads, and none of those people have come forward and identified themselves. So it's not clear what's going on there. The officers, with a witness in the back seat of the patrol car, went in search of the suspect. While Officer Over continued to question Mr. Newman, Officer Carey used the police radio to inform dispatch that they were searching for a man who had been observed brandishing a weapon. Within 2 or 3 minutes, Mr. Dine was identified by the eyewitness as the man he just observed brandishing the weapon. Mr. Dine was standing on the sidewalk with his back to the street. Interestingly enough, that's the first time we've heard that. That's not in any of the police reports, as far as we know. Not sure where we got that. The driver of the patrol car, Officer Carey, parked the vehicle at an angle pointed toward Mr. Dine and exited the car at the same time as Officer Over. Both officers walked around their car doors and began approaching Mr. Dine to attempt to make contact and conduct a search. Okay. Now, before we continue in this account, raising some points that we've raised in the past, Over was certainly knew Dine, had contacted him before, probably Carey knew Dine as well, though it's not clear in that, and we'll never know that, because the board refused to look into the officers' personnel files to determine if they'd had prior contact, if they'd been prior complaints against them, if they had had, they didn't want to question them as to whether they had prior contact with John Dine. And that, of course, would have been a crucial question. And did Ben Newman have prior contact with Dine? Was there some sort of problem between the two of them? Again, none of this would necessarily indicate you know, a finding of murder against Officer Carey, or even a finding of impropriety, but it would give us the picture as to what really went on. But the board was not terribly interested in any further investigations into what really went on. They apparently felt that the account of Officer Connor Carey, Officer Over, and Ben Newman were sufficient, in spite of the fact that they contradicted the accounts of Leanna Forrest, Alani Ballowager, Mike Schultz, Stacy Buckaloo, Tom Murphy, and four other witnesses, all, again, that are paraded for our attention in the DA's report in the library. Questions were raised at the driver of the patrol car. Carey parked the vehicle at an angle, pointed toward Mr. Dine, and exited the car at the same time as Officer Over. Both walked around their car doors. Some have said why. And they've said that, you know, why not use your car as a shield if you think the man is armed? They had reports he was armed. Why did they just sort of walk around after him like that? I don't know what police procedure is, but I can say from personal testimony, a week ago, I saw police officers, and I mentioned it on this show, there were five squad cars late at night stopping a man in the 76 Union Station on Soquel near Frederick Street. They were all behind their car doors, and they had their loudspeakers out, and they were broadcasting, "Put your hands up, put your hands up," and so forth. One would have thought that they were going after someone with a gun. They would have done the same thing, particularly since there were no other citizens and civilians in the area, so they weren't moving into a situation where they had to worry about somebody else getting immediately shot. Again, questions not asked the police officers, not asked police superiors, not asked anyone, unasked questions. Both officers walked around their car doors, according to the Citizens Police Review Board, and began approaching Mr. Dine to attempt to make contact and conduct a search. As both officers spoke to him while moving closer, Mr. Dine began to turn to his right to face them. Mr. Dine completed his turn to fully face Officer Carey. At this point, Officer Carey pulled his gun from his holster and pointed it at Mr. Dine. Again, if you believe this account, you might ask, why is he pulling his gun from his holster? If he thinks he's armed, why doesn't he stand back and wait? There's no mention in this report that we see anything in Dine's hand, that he sees any weapon, because indeed, none of the witnesses saw that except Officer Over and Ben Newman. And one has to believe that their testimony has been somewhat discredited, because even though they were the lead story in the Sentinel and on the news media for the first few weeks afterward, now that story has disappeared in favor of the story which you will now hear. At this point, Officer Carey pulled his gun from his holster and pointed it at Mr. Dine. Both officers spoke to Mr. Dine, and Mr. Dine received the command to not move in a clear, loud voice. With his right arm and hand close to his body, Mr. Dine reached into either his waistband or front right pocket and began the motion of removing what appeared to be a handgun from his waist area. This is the news story. Actually, the story that Carey has had all along, but not the story that the media and the police chief and the district attorney have trumpeted as what happened that night. It's become so thin, such an obvious tissue of lies, or let's say so false, that they can no longer say that that's what happened. So now the story changes. Instead, he was reaching for something. So now they can say, well, yeah, he didn't have anything in his hand. Well, yeah, he wasn't pointing a gun at him. Well, yeah, he wasn't in a combat stance. All the allegations that were made and reaffirmed 16 hours after the killing by the police chief and the district attorney, and then again a week and a half later by both those men. Not to mention the Santa Cruz Sentinel and the Santa Cruz Metro. With his right arm and hand close to his body, Mr. Dine reached into either his waistband or front right pocket and began the motion of removing what appeared to be a handgun from his waist area. At that moment, Officer Carey perceived an immediate and grave threat to his life, and acting in accordance with police policy and procedures, he discharged his weapon. Why did he have his weapon out in the first place? Questions not asked. Backup arrived within minutes, and the officers were immediately separated from each other. Now, there's no discussion here of the claim made by at least three witnesses, Clinton Hannis, Mike Schultz, and somewhat corroborated by John Blake, that Officer Over moved in, either Officer Over or Officer Carey, moved in, immediately began rummaging through Dine's clothing, pulled something from his clothing, and threw it to the ground. The toy gun that was later found there. The reason that this is so interesting is because, of course, when they were touting the first story, that he was pointing a gun, pointing a gun, pointing a gun, pointing a gun, threatening in combat stance, he obviously wouldn't have had it in his clothing anymore. It wouldn't have been there, because it would have fallen when he fell. So it would seem possible or even likely that what was happening there was that the police officers were moving in to look for a toy gun on his clothing as a sort of an exoneration of what they did. And that was the concern of a number of people. But again, there's no mention of any of this witness testimony. It's either given no credibility, it's dismissed. We don't even know what's happened to it. It's just not there. The officers had no further contact with Mr. Newman from the time they exited the vehicle to approach Mr. Dine. The interviews with Carey, Over, and Newman conducted within hours of the incident produced strong and compelling consistencies. Notice this kind of rhetoric. Yeah, they did produce consistencies. They all agreed they were at Soquel and Front Street. It was, in fact, a bus stop. It was night. It turned out to have been Happy John Dine, and they were all driving in a squad car. But what was significant, of course, were the inconsistencies, that two of these witnesses say that that Dine was pointing a weapon at the police. The two of the witnesses say that he had a weapon in his hand. The two of the witnesses say he assumed a combat stance. And the third witness, Officer Carey, the man who did the shooting, said he was reaching for a weapon. That's not consistent. That's inconsistent in crucial aspects. And, of course, I'm hoping that those who've done more research in the minutia of the report will call in and give us some details as to how the internal testimony of Martin, Over, and Newman are full of contradictions, which are nowhere discussed in this report. In fact, we have a phone call coming in. Let's move to the phone line and interrupt this reading of the Citizens Police Review Board Monday-Tuesday report.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Oh, hi, this is Nicholas calling in from Live Oak.
Ah, hi, Nick. We're, I guess, can you hear us there, or are you just sort of...
No, I haven't been able to tune in the station. Maybe it's the weather.
Well, let's take a break then from what we're doing so you can have a word. I know you work with SPAN, Stop Police Abuse
Now.
Now
I'm an investigator with Stop Police Abuse Now, SPAN.
And what's cooking?
Well, I want to draw people's attention to a case, court case, in Santa Cruz tomorrow at 10 a.m. in the morning, because I think there's police abuse involved here. And as is usually the case, the person who was abused is themselves having to defend themselves on a charge,
mm-hmm.
a battery. That's a typical thing. The police put somebody down, usually in numbers, and then the person has to go to court, and they're the one who's held accountable.
Mm-hmm.
So this gentleman lives in Beach Flats. And he has a condition that's manic depressive, which sounds pretty severe, if you look at those two words. But it's just a definition of a mental excitement state. It's just what people would commonly call the ups and downs, except in his case that sometimes... he told me that the worst it ever makes him is that he yells. He gets tense. And he yells. So he's lived with this for 10 years. You know, it's an incapacity of his
mm-hmm.
that he lives with. It doesn't make him dysfunctional in other regards. It's a periodic, recurring thing. Okay. So well, this attracts the attention of the neighbors, and the police are summoned, which is probably as it should be. Quieting somebody down. That's a standard thing that happens all the time in communities. Well, he hadn't done anything violent, and he wasn't involved with a weapon or anything. There were five police came there that night.
Santa Cruz police?
Yeah, SCPD. But with them was a Boardwalk employee. And that introduces another element in itself, because that's the one he's accused of battery on. Not accused of battery on police officers. And I guess he thought, well, probably took the Boardwalk employee to be a non-cop. He describes him as a civilian, so I'm wondering how that man was attired, whether he was in uniform or not, but let's leave that just for a minute. So the police came and tried to take him away, because he'd been excited and yelling.
Did they arrest him for disturbing the peace, or...?
The way he describes it, they were trying to pull me down, and I tried to shake them off.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So I asked him, well, to what extent did you try to shake them off? And he said, well, I was really just not wanting to go with them and wondered why they were doing this to me.
Mm-hmm.
He said they did not try to negotiate with him or communicate with him. It was strictly a physical thing.
Did they say he was charged with a particular crime and he was under arrest?
He didn't mention that. He was taken to the Dominican hospital.
Sounds like a 5150 of some sort. Psychiatric hold.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing that bothers me a lot about this is that he was slung against the trunk of the police car.
Who did that?
Well, I'm assuming that's the officers, because he didn't mention the other civilian.
Mm-hmm.
He was slung against the trunk of a police car, and to the extent that his nose was bloodied.
Mm-hmm.
So there was definitely quite a degree of violence involved here.
And is he charged with a crime? Oh, I guess he is. He's appearing in court tomorrow. What charge was he charged?
He was charged with battery on the person who first grabbed him. This is another bizarre thing. The person who first grabbed him was not the police.
Right.
But this boardwalk employee.
Well, it sounds like a kind of solidarity with the wannabe cops. You know, we've actually talked on this show about boardwalk, I call them seaside goon squads, because
uh-huh.
they've gone after, Hapless Harry has talked about his case on the air. He was harassed for asking about the policy of the boardwalk as of apparently confiscating your bicycle or skateboard for 72 hours.
That's a lot of power.
Yeah, right. And they, you know, they threw him down, they charged him, they arrested him, and then, of course, they never showed up in court, and the charges were dropped. So maybe we should, you know, show up in court tomorrow. I guess there'll be an arraignment tomorrow for your case that you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
We don't even know if charges will actually be brought. And, of course, an arraignment is really not a terribly interesting procedure, although it can be an opportunity to give solidarity.
Well, this is not the first. No,
oh.
It's gone to the extent that...
Oh, this is a pretrial then, huh?
His public defender has... He's not satisfied with the public defender's position. He feels he was attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And the public defender is trying to put in a plea on his behalf. Is that something they can do?
Well, I think they can try to do that. I think he can resist it. He can try to fire his public defender. He should vigorously attempt to assert his rights and audibly do so in court as well. Say, Your Honor, and say so for the record. I do not want this man to represent me. I will represent myself until such time as I can find adequate counsel. Although that's a risky thing to do too, because you got to know all the ins and outs of the legal game to really get the benefits of this crazy system.
Yeah.
So this is tomorrow at 8:30 in whose court?
No, it's at 10 o'clock.
I'm sorry, 10 o'clock.
Commissioner Salazar's.
And what's the name of the defendant?
Court is Angel de Fuego.
Angel de Fuego?
Angel de Fuego.
Okay, Mr. de Fuego, in Department 2, in case you're interested, this looks like it's more than an arraignment. It's some kind of pretrial hearing, so...
It does, because the way he described it to me, he said, my public defender went into a room with the prosecutor and judge and came out smiling, telling me that I would only have to do 45 days the way she'd fixed it.
Right. Well, I think he should go for a trial if he feels he's innocent and he wants to take the risk of a longer sentence, because that's always a consideration. But for those who are interested, do show up tomorrow, 10 o'clock, Department 2, the Del Fuego case. And if you have cases yourself that you're concerned about for police misconduct of any kind or security guard brutality or just irregular procedures, can they give you a call, Nick?
Sure.
And what's your number?
My number is 475-2012.
475-2012.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to bring our attention to?
Yeah, I just want to point out this raises the whole question of whether a person who has not been medically diagnosed and is not receiving medicine should really be held accountable like any other citizen, because this wouldn't have happened, his behavior wouldn't have happened if he had earlier been diagnosed. He has, since that police incident, got a diagnosis that he finds helpful. Mm-hmm. And he's been put on the right medicine for himself, mm-hmm. which actually is Lithium.
Yeah, well, that's another question, too. There was always a question of what you're going to do with these psychiatric categories, and that's a whole ball of worms.
Yeah, and this was not a loser guy, not a layabout guy. This man had worked as a mechanical engineer in the maintenance section of a Stanford University campus on high physics stuff. This is a guy with an interesting background.
Mm-hmm.
And some chemical thing happened in his brain and incapacitated his ability to work, and so he retired.
Well, maybe we can, those who are interested can show up tomorrow at 10 and Department 2 and actually take a closer look at what's going on.
Let me just say this about what he told me on the security guards.
Mm-hmm.
I said, who is the security guard who came and joined the police action and grabbed a hold of you? That's an unauthorized move. He said, this security guard has a history of violence down in the boardwalk area.
Do we know his name?
No. I got a description, but no name.
Well, perhaps it's time for us to send in a couple of sting teams down there.
Yeah. With cameras.
With cameras and...
what's going on at odd hours.
And lots of padding.
So I said, well, you say he's got a history of violence. And he said, well, I know for a fact that he went with the cops to my friend's house one day and pulled him out of the front door. Almost acting as an adjunct to the cops, and this
Well, if perhaps they'll show up in court tomorrow, we can get his name.
Yeah, I think it will be good to show some solidarity.
So 10 o'clock tomorrow, Department 2, and if you want to help this case further or give Nick concerns of your own, it's 475-2012.
Right,
that's
on.
Number for SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Nick.
Okay.
All right.
Got to keep an eye on these things, because remember, it was a security guard who went with the police, and this led to John Dine's death.
That's correct.
So these kind of wannabe police are a factor we have to deal with all the time now.
That's for sure.
All right, man.
Thank you, Nick.
Good night.
True enough. Well, we are Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and it looks like we got the phone lines ringing here. I want to get back to this report soon, but let's see what we got on the phone.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Well, if not that his ashes were scattered at sea, John Dine's body would lie moldering in the grave.
Indeed. Sounds like Bob to me. Hi, Bob.
Well, Robert, how you doing?
I think I recognize that voice. Did you read this report? Have you seen the report of the Citizens Police Review Board on the Dine case, the final nail in the coffin, so to speak?
Well, I wouldn't call it final. This thing is far from being final in terms of what public pressure can ultimately produce.
Mm-hmm.
But let's remember that this stuff, like this, the public package, that's just what it is. It's what's stated. And it's mostly immaterial puff. Okay, there are a handful of things that have some relevance, but even the things that have relevance are created. The language is created. The questions are created. The depth of the questioning is created. Okay, there's a context for understanding this. And as you were talking about earlier, the way that this thing was spun out, okay, 16 hours later, televised summary judgment, this ought to indicate something to people. All right. Now, just some brief stuff on the chronology. Martin Krall, who does the summary in the public package,
DA's investigation.
Right. Now, he is called at home by Adrian Simons at 19:30, which is 7:30. Now, Dine gets shot at 6:40. Okay. This is what's stated. Remember, this is what's stated.
So you're saying the man who interviewed most of the witnesses, Marty Krall, from the district attorney's office, is called about an hour after the shooting?
He's called by Adrian Simons, 7:30. And then Krall calls Alan Johnson, 7:35.
Who is another member of the DA's department.
Right. Now, Newman, the interviews start about 9:40. Newman is interviewed 9:41.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I think it's sincere. When was Art Danner contacted? Just because it's not stated doesn't mean that it didn't come down that night. Did Art Danner contact Belcher that night or vice versa? If so, when?
Mm-hmm.
Because there can be no question that this thing was staged. Obviously, there was no combat stance. All right. All the staging initially was, I think, designed.
Well, I think they were definitely trying to put the best face on the thing. No question.
And there's many points that, just a couple of points I think are important. How in the dark was Martin overkept until the encounter? Newman and Carey they conferred privately before they all got together in the police car.
Hmm.
Okay, and when you put that in context with Newman and Carey being friends, it does raise some interesting issues. All right.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, no questions were asked about that private conversation.
Right. Now, Martin Over is in the dark to a large degree initially.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they pull up to the guy, and, yeah, they walk right up to him, basically. They don't get in any kind of a defensive position behind their cop car doors or use their megaphones, and it is extremely sincere to ask, did they know or suspect it was a toy gun before they approached him?
Also, of course, what did Over say to Officer Carey, Over, who had definite knowledge of who Dine was and the kinds of things he did on the mall, and did, in fact, after the shooting, when there was an angry interchange between Over and Carey, was Over saying to Carey, what did you do? What did you do?
Now, let's put some common sense to this.
Yeah.
If they hear there's somebody brandishing a gun, they do like what you were talking about in front of the Union Station. This is just common sense. They walk right up to this guy. Martin Over says, hi, happy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, there is a scenario where this guy, Mr. Dine, might have been torqued enough. He might have wanted to show them it was a toy gun. We don't know what the specific things were said. Let's remember, what's stated is not necessarily what went down. This is an important point. Do you follow what I'm saying, Robert?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have these official statements. What's stated is not necessarily what went down. We do not know what went down.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's very true, Bob. But even based upon what was stated, there are so many contradictions, inconsistencies, and really the need to ask the questions again from an independent perspective that it really boggles the mind to think that the Citizens Police Review Board, established by the Progressive City Council in the most crucial case of its career, has decided to do nothing.
Well, you got to figure that the CPRB was co-opted from the start, and any member that was effective resigned. So what you're left with is, I'm going to try to find a mellow way to put this, but a very agreeable bureaucracy. I think that's mellow, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty...
I stress the key to this, because this issue does have relevance in a lot of good, meaningful ways that are diplomatic, that revolve around police procedures, that revolve around the way things are conducted on the out end by high-ranking officials. Public pressure is the key to this. Okay, we cannot just say that the guy was a crackpot. You know, most of the public package... is all about the pills that John Dine was on and all this stuff that is basically immaterial.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that out of that package, which is about 2 inches thick, that 1¾ inches of it is worthless.
Of course, the package you're talking about is the district attorney's report, which anyone can find in the reference section of the Santa Cruz Main Library. Let me ask you this, Bob.
A stated public package, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. You've been closely following other talk shows around this issue, and you've weighed in on those shows with your thoughts on the Dine case. Did you hear any conversations in talk shows after the Citizens Police Review Board report came out?
I haven't tuned in, really, but I suspect... not. I suspect that unless there's a way to find a way found to gracefully approach the mainstream, the intention is for this issue to die,
mm-hmm.
fall away. End of story, on to the next puff piece.
Well, I continue to suggest to people, particularly, you know, you and others who have, you know, relevant and trenchant points to make about the, specifically about the Citizens Police Review Board treatment of this, that it's time for a few letters to the Metro, to the City on a Hill, to the Sentinel, which I think, you know, are timely, and I think they will print at least one or two of them.
I never really thought much would come out of the Citizens Police Review Board, just by the very nature of the way that it's established.
I didn't
All
either,
right.
but I had my hopes.
The key is public pressure. The only reason why a situation like this would be handled differently would be that the citizens of the community demand open, honest government.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of public pressure to whom do you suggest people go, Bob?
I think that even talk shows, media, there are a lot of good perspectives on this, including people that get up in front of oral communication and speak. There's a point where that has some relevance if it can be done in diplomatic and polite terms. If a way can be reached to show that this should not die as a relevant issue, there are some questions that simply have not been addressed and have been refused to be addressed all along, and let's sincerely look at the way this was handled on the out end, and can we truly walk away from this with a straight face and call ourselves human beings?
Well, apparently the Citizens Police Review Board says yes, and I'm afraid that in 2 weeks you'll find the City Council will say exactly the same thing. Celia Scott has put the issue on the agenda, but she apparently has already told the media that she considers the issue closed as far as an independent investigation goes, and the only thing that City Council will be considering in 2 weeks will be the recommendations, which I'm going to read, but I mean they are innocuous and essentially irrelevant recommendations that don't have much to do with, you know, even such concerns as when should lethal force be used, can the police department please clarify what its policies are for folks? Do they approach immediately, you know, or do they hide, you know, do they seek cover? And there's no, you know, are soft nose bullets a good approach to things because they're so lethal? I mean, all questions we've raised in the course of this investigation, none of those questions are on the recommendations of the CPRB. In fact, I'll skip to those right now. What they are they recommend to the City Council, not even to the police department.
Hang on, Robert, because I want to get off the air quickly. Let me just say this. If an issue is a good issue, you never let it go.
Well,
all right? And this issue, it doesn't matter what is done necessarily by those that consider themselves to be leaders or in positions of authority. Mm-hmm. If the issue is sincere and relevant and truthful, then it warrants and justifies activism.
Well,
now, let me ask you something, Mr. Norris.
Yeah, although I'm trying to get to this, but
okay,
go ahead.
Okay, then I'm going to go. I'm going to hang up and let go. When do you plan on letting this issue go?
Well, the problem is, I probably going to let it go pretty quick. I mean, I'm not going to let it go in a certain sense, as you say. I'll never let it go. I mean, it'll always be on the burner, waiting for hopefully some kind of resolution. And frankly, I think it'll arise again with a vengeance the next time there's an incident of police brutality or abuse, because you know you think you can cover it up, but I don't think so.
Let's remember that 1998 is an election year.
Yeah.
Thank you for letting me get on the air.
All right, Bob.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3. We're talking about the Happy John Dine, what I've called in the past a cover-up. The Citizens Police Review Board's report on this, which was issued on Tuesday, which in essence ratified, cleared the board of all complaints against the police department for its actions in the Happy John Dine case, declined to go in an independent investigation, refused to ask for public hearings, and in essence presented us with the latest cover story, the latest formulation of the police department to kind of patch together what happened that night from their perspective, which unfortunately seems to be more concerned with putting a good face on things than getting to the truth. The four recommendations that they came up with were not even recommendations to the chief of police. They were recommendations to the city council, perhaps showing how apprehensive they are of offending Chief Belcher. The recommendations were to conduct an assessment of the training of officers and the identification and handling of mentally and emotionally disabled individuals. Notice that the very phrasing of that tends to diminish the responsibility of the police department and to diminish the credibility of the individual who was shot. He's a mentally and emotionally disabled individual who required some kind of special treatment, and therefore we can understand how the police needed really special training in dealing with him. It wasn't like a citizen's civil liberties were cut short, that a human being was shot dead. It's more that here was an emotionally and mentally disabled person, a kind of a weirdo that they couldn't really handle too well. Well, let's train them a little better. Number two, conduct an assessment of the practices and procedures for integrating officers into the downtown area or any other area that attracts a high population of the mentally and emotionally disabled. Again, a tag phrase for dismissing this entire thing as an aberration. Three, request an audit of John Dine's case management from mental health officials that were responsible for his care and case management. John Dine, his case management. It's the problem of the authorities who are dealing with him. It's his fault. It's his error. It's not the police department in terms of its trainings, policies with respect to the use of weapons, perhaps the way that individuals who are surfers together, like Kerry and Newman were, and schmooze together, and lack of communication between other police officers and actually getting out information about what's going on downtown. It's not a problem in the communication within the police department or bias by the police in favor of prejudice against homeless people or poor people, because it's been alleged by Dine's friends that he was frequently harassed by the police. It's not a question of full and thorough investigation by the police department when it's obvious that many, many questions were not asked that should have been asked. No, it's only a question of Dine and his care, emotionally disabled and mentally disabled individuals. And finally, they recommend the city council look into the drafting of an ordinance limiting the sale and ownership of realistic-looking toy guns. Well, it's really hard to even respond to this. I also have one recommendation to the police chief. They're looking for an educational outreach program to schools regarding toy guns and initiating a voluntary toy gun turn-in program. Can you imagine that a man's dead and they're talking about a toy gun turn-in program? How about a toy justice turn-in program? What we need is a real transformation there. Phone call on the subject.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, hello. May I clarify a few points about the Dine thing?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay.
We're talking to Al, right?
Yes.
Go ahead, Al.
This is according to the testimony by Officer Carey himself. Here is, in essence, what he said. When they approached Dine, when he was out of the car, Dine was turned around. And the mode or the style in the way that Dine supposedly turned around, according to Carey, frightened him in some sense. In other words, he may have,
pirouetted or something.
Pardon me?
He may have kind of danced around or...
Not necessarily. He could have... He claims that the way that Dine turned around made him pull his weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Because he termed it aggressive. He turned around in an aggressive way. Now, I don't know what Dine was doing, facing the wall. It could have been any number of things. Maybe he was taking a leak, for all I know.
Mm-hmm.
But this is what Carey claims. And at some time, I guess, immediately, within seconds, he yelled at him really loud to not move. Now, evidently, Dine, according to Carey, this is still what is in the report, word for word, Dine started reaching in his pocket and started pulling out this supposed weapon. Now, let's go real slow, because here is what Carey is saying. The second he could see the handle of this object, which in a split second to him represented the revolver and not any other kind of weapon. In other words, he says that it wasn't an automatic, which has a square handle. It was a roundish handle. Now, what that statement means is that at this split second, I know this probably happened all fast, and Officer Carey was frightened by the way that he moved around, and out comes this handle. Now, if Officer Carey, now here is something what I say. If he saw the handle of the supposed gun, if somebody had the handle in their hand, like they were ready to fire, it would have been not visible. So if Officer Carey claims that he saw the handle, and then this is what he says, at that split second he decided to fire. So according to Carey himself, the weapon that he fired the second that the handle showed, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened to the weapon, if he got hit, Dine got hit, he could have just yanked his arms up or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have had it, I don't know. I mean, he could have had something in his hand and whatever went which way, but, he dropped fast. Now, this, again, is going crossing over directly to Overt's statement. Okay, Overt at that second stated that it happened so fast that Overt did not even get his gun into firing position before Dine was on the ground already.
Mm-hmm.
He just, according to Overt, he just dropped like a sack of potatoes. So, according to the testimony, the gun never went into any kind of firing position before he got shot. Now, whatever that means...
Because that's the new testimony. The old testimony...
No, that's not any testimony. That's in the report.
No,
that's
but the story given by the district attorney and the police chief was essentially the Newman story beforehand. And Newman's story was that Dine had the gun out and was pointing it at both of them.
Well, this is... Well, okay. Yeah, well, look...
And that was the story that they originally took. I'm just saying that...
Yeah.
You know, what I'm saying is that they're patching things up 2 months down the line.
Well, I'm just pointing out that... Carey claims, you know, that he fired as the handle showed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the handle must have not been in his hand. He must have pulled it out by the barrel. I don't know. Maybe he was going to hand it to him. But the thing is, you know...
Good point. You know, amazing. So
no,
what you
this
said,
is in the report.
Right. No,
this
I hear
what
you. I read it, yeah.
Officer Carey, you know, himself says. I mean, you know, hey, I'm just going by what he says.
Right.
You know, I mean... You know, some poor guy gets shot, but I can see it. You know, I'm open-minded enough to can... I can understand, you know, if the officer is...
So what is your...
Kind of apprehensive, I mean...
What is your conclusion, Al? Did officer... Do you think that...
I wasn't there.
No, but based... Do you feel that if things were as... how do you think things were based upon the reports you've read?
Well, I just go by what the interview... of Officer Carey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me... I'd like to go on with one other point.
Go ahead.
Because that's a very important one.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, or, you know, within real time or interview time, Officer Carey was asked, how far were you from Dine when you shot? He claims... Get this. This is it. This is... Word for word in his interview, 15 yards.
Mm-hmm.
How many feet is that?
That's 45 feet.
Yeah, you know how far away that is?
That's almost across the street.
That's almost across the street. And the interviewer asked, now, wait a minute, are you talking 15 yards or 15 feet? And he keeps saying, 15 yards. And the guy points out, well, that's like two car lengths. Now, what was going on? In a way, I mean, I'm sorry. I think anybody that reads this would come to the same conclusion. This is not just trying to come down heavy, you know, on this officer, like, personally. But it seemed to me like he was preventing from saying that he was close enough to where he potentially could have physically prevented Dine from any other movements without having to shoot him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's general agreement by other witnesses that, you know, he was within, what, 10 or 15 feet? Or closer?
Well,
some say even 5 feet.
What I'm saying is, see, I wasn't there, and what I'm saying is, I become suspicious when someone claims an outlandish number that doesn't fit into the scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it makes me wonder if he's trying to hide that he really was close enough and he could have done something else.
Well, unfortunately, we'll never know if the police review board had that same concern because they didn't hold public hearings and they didn't allow us any insight into their process.
Well,
I mean,
so what?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of us who are hoping that there would be that police review board would serve as a kind of public focus for the kinds of unanswered questions and unasked questions that you are bringing up.
Right, but then, to be fair, okay, going along with the scenario, you can counter that and say, well, Dine obviously did not comply to not move. Do you see what I'm saying? And this is the toss-up. Now, how much, you know, see what I'm saying? Like,
it depends.
Like,
you see, your entire account is based upon taking simply Officer Carey and possibly Officer Over's testimony. There were other people who observed this scene. And I think we cannot make the mistake that the police chief, the district attorney, and now the Citizens Police Review Board have made, which is simply to look at the testimony of the police officers and of the police officer's friend, Ben Newman.
Well, what I'm pointing out is that there are discrepancies in the police officer's account.
Indeed, and I think that's also important. Oh, yeah, no question.
And I think there is one account of Carey communicating with Ben Newman before they were put into so-called, you know, separation.
Mm-hmm.
I think he walked by the window of the car and they had an exchange.
You know,
kind of an affirmative, you know, mutual witnessing exchange. But why Officer Carey has to claim that he was 35 feet away...
Yeah, we don't know.
I mean, you know...
45 feet, actually.
45, yeah, that's almost...
Well, you know, another thing, when I spoke to Sergeant Crane the other night after the, I guess it was either the city council meeting or the police review board...
Right.
And he told me, first of all, he affirmed it was 5 seconds. Sergeant Crane is the head of the Police Officers Association. He's the president at this time. And he also pointed out that he Officer Over had been strictly sequestered and removed from the scene. Of the shooting, both Over and Carey.
That's true?
Well, actually, it wasn't true. Because, it may have been true initially, but it certainly wasn't true when I arrived on the scene at 9:45.
You were still there?
When I arrived on the scene at 9:45, Over arrived, walked onto the scene, and began talking with other police officers.
Oh, he did?
Yes, he
did.
Well,
see, there's...
He's on videotape. I've seen him on videotape as well. It wasn't my imagination, and I commented on him as he arrived.
Well,
Officer
then that's
Over
a fact.
Yes.
That's a fact. If you have proof of a fact, then...
Right. Well, we had plenty of facts we brought to the CPRB, but none of them seemed to merit any kind of consideration of any real sort. At least none of it was even reflected in the report, which is what, of course, I've been reading here. Anything else I can do, Al? I want to move on to the next segment here.
Okay, the last thing I have to say is if that board doesn't work, I think the people of Santa Cruz, if they look into that report that, you know, themselves, should voice their personal outcry over this and create their own board.
I agree. And we've been talking about that. In fact,
that's the point. If enough people see discrepancies, you know, like real discrepancies, people should get together.
I hope we do. I'll bring that up on the air.
Come next to the, if there is a city council, at any time there's a public meeting. If anybody is concerned, the more people that get together, if they really, you know, find something wrong with this, that's the only thing that's going to make any difference.
Thank you, Al.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
And, of course, Al is right. It's public outcry, and as Bob LaMonica said, it's public pressure and not letting the issue die that is really important here. Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure was a group that was following this issue. We haven't really met in a couple of weeks, but there are folks interested. And if you are interested in having another meeting of Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure, give me a call at 423-4833. To say so. We haven't had enough real interest to pull together a meeting, but if folks want to do something, we were talking about having an independent tribunal, about bringing in folks from out of town to really investigate the matter as best we can, let me know. 423-4833. We now have another caller.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Oh, hi, this is Nicholas again.
Hi, Nicholas.
I just wanted to pick up on something that Al had said there.
Mm-hmm.
Asking that question, why was the officer Connor Carey's statement that he was that many yards, 15 yards. Mm-hmm. This might be something to do with recommended police procedures from the department. He didn't want to admit officially that he was that close, because I bet you there's a rule that they're not supposed to go that close to a person suspected of being armed.
Could be.
I mean, they're endangering their own life.
Well, thank you for that addition, Nick. I'm going to cut you out quickly unless you've got more to say, because I want to run on to the next segment here.
Yeah, I just want to add about the use of deadly force by the department.
Mm-hmm.
Deputy Chief Locke told me in a telephone interview that they do definitely shoot to kill. That is the policy. When an assailant or a potential assailant has a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him, would that apply to a knife? He said yes to a knife also. I got the similar response from the trainer of police at the nearest local police academy over in the San Jose area. And these standards are set by some state-level commission on police conduct.
Okay.
That's not a very civilian-oriented...
No, it's not, nor is using soft-nosed bullets. But let me move on.
Yeah.
Thanks
so
a lot, Nick.
That's an issue that really has to be taken up with the public. Do we want our police to always use deadly force? And I just want to leave this one question hanging there. Why could he not have been... Why could he not have been more patient, done a little stakeout on the spot, had someone come from behind, and done
right.
something without firing shots, with a net or some other subterfuge?
Thank you, Nick.
Yeah.
And, of course, that question has been raised by others as well, but it was not raised by the Citizens Police Review Board, apparently, at least not in their report. A couple more brief statements from this before we move on. The board attributes the majority of the inconsistencies to distance from the incident, darkness, vantage point, and the expected variances of human observation. Some of the allegations made by witnesses were so inconsistent with the known facts that the board had to reduce its confidence in the overall accuracy of those witness statements, but apparently not the two police witnesses and the police officer's friend, Ben Newman. In the end, the board found the officer's statements believable and the preponderance of the evidence in support of the exoneration of Officer Carey and other officers named in the complaints from any charges of excessive use of force. They're really kind of repeating what we know already. We are not learning anything new about their why they decided what they decided, what witnesses were not credible, what were the known facts, and from whom do they get these known facts. Again, we don't know. They don't say. Dr. Bill Christie, the chair of the board, who spoke at the press conference, and I guess this has been played on the air, so unfortunately I'm not really going to have time to play it today. And we had quite a go-around with that. He said he would make available, he would respond to questions on this issue later on, written questions, and I'm hoping that that's true. But unfortunately, I know that at least one board member, Mr. Morse, Bruce Morse, I think he's Mike Rotkin's appointee, made an arrangement to meet with several of us to talk to us about what went on, and then not only didn't show up at the meeting, but didn't even call us to cancel the meeting. So low was his respect for those of us who, were trying to investigate this matter, and apparently were embarrassing his board. I found that really sort of a sad thing. But I think we should pose questions to the board. I think that it might be time to pose a series of phoned questions to the board at 429-3262. That's a 24-hour message phone. Call them up and specifically ask for their response about these discrepancies. And if enough people call in with concerns, it's not unprecedented that a case could be reopened. In fact, a new complaint could be filed. And that's a process that can be undertaken as well. We don't have to let this matter rest. The question about the most effective way to do it, I don't know. I know that fewer and fewer people came to Santa Cruzans for full disclosure meetings, probably because of the vacations, the flu, the bad weather, all these things are factors. But also, I have to admit that the amount of time that this case has taken up for me and for others in terms of taking away from other issues, like shelter issues, like folks sleeping out in the rain, getting pneumonia, like just low-grade abuse. I, for example, heard a case of a guy, I've talked to you about this bus situation where Patricia Gardella was, told she couldn't sit on a bus even though she had an all-day pass because of the way she looked, apparently, or whatever mystical reason they had. We cannot investigate those cases because our time is being taken up with this shooting case, and the problem is, where are we going with it? This is really the question I have for you, the audience, and those who are concerned about it. If people want to put in some full time on this issue and they want to really try to get together an independent tribunal, that could be done. And we have some people who've actually volunteered to do that. But it would be quite a time-consuming activity. And I want folks who are interested in volunteering their time to give me a call, 423-4833. And, maybe we'll try and do something like that. There's also another thing that's very important to many of us, which is the Sleeping Ban Repeal Initiative. That repeal initiative is due to hit the streets any day now. We have it ready. All we need to do is print it up, and we need people out there who are willing to sign folks up. That, again, is an initiative to make it legal for people to sleep at night without being harassed by the police if they're not engaging in any other kind of criminal behavior in non-residential sections of the city. Actually, it makes it legal to sleep everywhere, but allows the city council to put residential areas off limits for homeless people or for folks who are sleeping at night. It's quite a good initiative. It would be a major change for the better for the 500 to 1,500 homeless people in Santa Cruz city area. It makes it kind of puts common sense back in the driver's seat. It puts compassion, you know, right behind the steering wheel again, to some extent, although not really. I mean, it's at least it says, you know, it's still illegal to put up a tent, mind you, or to shield yourself against the elements, but at least if you fall asleep, you're not going to be arrested for closing your eyes since there's no legal place for people to sleep, the overwhelming majority of the homeless people in Santa Cruz, even in the winter. There are less than 200 shelter spaces, by which we mean floor spaces, at night. So, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris, and you're listening to Bathrobespierre's Broadsides. I'm the guy in the bathrobe who shows up at all these sleeping demonstrations, or used to when we had them. I guess I still do in San Francisco. I was up there at the park, recently got a ticket for being in the park after dark. You can, of course, get a ticket here in Santa Cruz for being in the park after dark. Thanks to Lebensraum Jim Lang, our Parks and Rec director, he's seen to it that all the parks close at sunset. And now the entire riverfront closes after sunset. You can't even walk up and down there at night. I've commented on this in the past. Out of time soon, how quickly it all goes. Here's a bulletin from Fullerton near Buena Park, California. Judge okays steps taken by Reverend Drake to comply with city codes. A municipal judge ruled last Thursday that the Reverend Wiley Drake and his church have taken reasonable steps to comply with the city building codes by limiting the number of vagrants on the property to 52, a prosecutor said. Assistant City Prosecutor Greg Palmer criticized the decision by Judge Greg L. Pickett, calling it a double standard that allows the First Southern Baptist Church of Buena Park and its pastor to break the law. The judge has treated this defendant differently than any other defendant, and the only reason I can think of for that is that this defendant happens to be a church, Palmer said. It's very unfair from the point of view that everybody else in the city is required to comply with the law except this church. Drake and his church were convicted of 4 misdemeanor counts for allowing homeless people to live in a patio structure and camp in a parking lot. In September, First Southern Baptist was placed on probation for 3 years in order to make good faith efforts to follow city ordinances. Drake was spared a jail sentence. The point of contention between the prosecutor and the judge appeared to be a dispute over what defines a good faith effort. Prickett said that the church complied with the order by limiting the number of vagrants. That's homeless people, folks, in the UPI kind of terminology, allowed on the property, and submitting plans to build another structure in accordance with city codes, attorneys on both sides said. The proposal for the new building, which will house up to 52 people, will be considered for approval next week. As long as our efforts are reasonable and in good faith, and the judge was not going to hold it over our heads whether there is a violation of probation, said Adlore Clarambeau, the pastor's attorney. But Palmer disagreed, saying church officials could have moved the homeless from the patio into other shelters throughout the county while plans are underway for the new building. City authorities even offered to help by donating 10 motel rooms to house the homeless for a week, but about 35 vagrants remain on church grounds, Palmer said. The judge basically said it's okay for them to be sleeping in cars, sleeping in the parking lot, even sleeping on the roof, yet they were also ordered to violate no law, Palmer said. Well, those things are inconsistent. Prickett also modified the terms of probation Thursday to allow the city to periodically inspect the church to ensure that no more than 52 people are living on the property at any one time, Palmer said. Although Drake and his attorney initially asked that the inspectors be from a neutral party rather than the city, both said they were satisfied in a general sense with the judge's ruling. We're happy they're going to leave us alone, Drake said. We could continue to do what we've been doing, and that's helping people. Actually, of course, the city pressure is making Drake kind of pressure people out of the church. I think he had about 70 some time ago, and the argument that a church shouldn't get special privileges is one I would normally be sympathetic to, except that Buena Park is notoriously anti-homeless and has made it illegal for people to sleep on the streets, sleep in vehicles. It has virtually no shelter space, and it's actually made it illegal to stay for more than 30 days in a motel because they don't want homeless people to use their motels as shelter space. So it's really quite disingenuous for the prosecutor there to claim that the church is acting inappropriately when the church is trying to meet a basic human need that the city is refusing to deal with. The city seems to say, well, if we decide we aren't going to allow basic civil rights here, like the right to sleep at night, then we can do it. No, they can't do it. And if other individuals are going to move in compassionately to try to deal with that, then they're going to try to dezone these folks out of existence or prosecute them. And in essence, even churches, whose main job is to deal with basic spiritual and material needs of human beings, it's grotesque and shows you the kind of condition that at least Buena Park is in, and even Santa Cruz. In Santa Cruz, we have a law making it illegal to cover up with blankets at night, for God's sake. Well, let's hear a little of Richard Quigley. I promised you that. Let's go for it. Bless me. Richard Quigley, again, I point out, is a civil rights activist here in Santa Cruz. Actually, I think he lives on the outskirts somewhere in Santa Cruz County. And he has been targeted by the Sheriff's Department after a brouhaha where he pointed out that the sheriffs were had created a special parking area for themselves at the new sheriff's substation, you know, had painted in a special parking zone that was illegal. And so Quigley himself parked in that zone, which prompted Deputy Deverill to begin to ticket him, not just there, but to try to go after him and his friends elsewhere, according to his allegation, and he is now fighting that in court. Let's hear a little bit about that. So we're on the line with infamous libertarian activist and sheriff's candidate. Hi, Richard.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. You're in a very crabby mood today.
I got a cold, man. I'm a little bit snappy, but that's okay.
Well, listen, I hear that you were... Apparently, they served you coffee at the roasting company, and then they served you up into the jail. Is that what happened? Or?
Oh, yeah, Aptos Roasting Company. You know, it's quite an interesting deal. But there's this bitch, and I mean steam-driven. We're talking about, you know, I can't use it on even your radio station, man, but let's put it this way. She cannot understand normal thinking. You got it?
Okay.
I mean, if you're into acronyms, you know what I got. So, anyway, this woman who this cannot understand normal thinking manager of that store.
Right. The Aptos Coffee Roasting Company.
No. She's a manager of Gottschalk's.
Oh, the manager of Gottschalk's. Okay.
Now catch this, because this is a funny rip. Okay.
Okay.
Here's the deal. She comes out on the 14th of October outside her store. I'm standing outside. I don't know who the hell she is. I'm standing there. Remember, I've told you about this story, the false arrest, where she arrested me while I was out there campaigning for sheriff?
This was in the Aptos Shopping Center.
Yeah.
Summarize it for
her, at the corner of her business, 30 foot away from her front door, is pretty much oblivious to what the store is. And like I said, I don't know her from Adam. She comes waddling up to me, because that's all somebody looks like that can do is waddle, and starts ordering me to move on. And I told her so many words to blow it out her fat.
Yes.
Now, you know, anyway, so she goes and gets Deverell, and Deverell comes over.
Deverell is the...
He's the super sergeant that now is a detective. He's the single worst cop in the whole goddamn county of Santa Cruz. It's not that he's most violent, but he's absolutely the seediest, crookedest, slimiest piece of crap God ever let walk, you know? I mean, I don't know how you get walking slime, but that he's it.
Okay.
Anyway... So he comes back out with her, and he says, did this woman ask you to leave, you know, ask you to move? And I says, no, as a matter of fact, she did. She told me to move, and I pretty much told her to blow it out her fat fucking ass. You got a problem with that sergeant.
Right.
And so he steps back and extends his arm to her, and she places me under arrest for a violation of 602.1 of the Penal Code, which is intentional interference with a business. She might as well have charged me with flying to the moon without a license, you know. I mean, it couldn't have been less related to what I was doing. Okay. The DA wouldn't follow up on this because, of course, it was absurd.
And were you actually physically taken into custody at that time?
Oh, yeah, no, cuffed up, hauled off to jail 3.5 hours before I got out. The whole movie. I'm just suing the bejesus out of Gottschalk's. What a bunch of jerks. Anyway.
Right.
So now the DA won't do nothing, so she comes back in with a sleazeball lawyer by the name of John Gallagher, not to be confused with Sean Gallagher, who's a hell of a good lawyer, but John M. Gallagher, who is... He is one of them guys, when you line up the weasels in this town, he don't have to take no number. He's got an honorary seat, okay?
Gotcha.
So here comes Weasel John Gallagher on behalf of Gottschalk's, and they move against me for a restraining order. They throw me in front of this visiting judge, They keep wanting to get a restraining order keeping me away from the Gottschalk store because I was accosted by this woman and reacted improperly. You understand what I'm at?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this judge issues the order because he's a little bit, you know, he ain't paying attention to what he's signing, and in spite of the fact that all through the transcript of the hearing, you can see him saying, no, I can't order him away from the store. He's got a constitutional right to be on the sidewalk in front of the store. He can hand out flyers in front of the store. All that doesn't matter. When he signs the order, this weasel Gallagher had it written in there, I had to be 25 yards from the Gottschalk store. Okay. The far exterior edge. This is what the order read.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't what he ruled, but it's what the order read. Okay. Now, I go into Coffee Roasting Company, which is 25 yards, three businesses away, but 25 yards from the extreme outside edge of the far corner of the Gottschalk store. According to the police report, the guy that manages the place called the shopping center manager, who called First Alarm, who called the sheriff's office, who filled out a complaint, they gave it to the district attorney. The filing district attorney said, no, I ain't gonna file this. We ain't got no case here. The guy ain't done nothing. You know, he ain't had nothing to do with bothering that woman, you know. He just went and got a cup of coffee. Sergeant Wilson says, well, Sheriff Tracy wants him arrested. So they go over to filing DA's head to some woman named Kate something or other. She's one of the bosses up there for Danner.
Mm-hmm.
This woman orders the filing DA to file a complaint against me. They run it in front of use of excessive force by Charles Crompton as a dollar Kelsey. You know him, don't you?
Yes, I know. Kelsey is an old pal of mine.
Oh, you know, it's wonderful that in these times, gods are actually allowed to manifest themselves in human form so that we can worship them. Thank you, Bill Kelsey. So this goddamn fool that he is, he decides to issue this warrant for my arrest for violating this restraining order by going to get a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm. A serious crime.
Yeah, victims all over the place. Mm-hmm. Heinous, heinous crime. And then he puts $5,000 bail on it, which is only five times the maximum amount and 10 times the normal amount, but they know that I'm the kind of guy that'll skip out. I won't show up in court, so they want to make damn sure I'm going to be there. So they put $5,000 bail on me and issue this warrant. I find out about the warrant. I get $5,000. I go down and post stuff. They book me and all this stuff, and now I'm going to trial.
And when is the trial date?
Okay, the trial date on that little Hummer is scheduled for the 9th of July, 9th of February, and it's with your old buddy, Heather Morse.
Oh, no.
No, it's okay.
Okay.
I think it's good to go this way because, you know, Heather's husband works for the guy that insisted that...